So, yeah, thanks a lot for the invitation to give this talk, first of all, and thanks for being here. So I will be talking about how we are trying to extract cosmology from fundamental quantum gravity models, but I've been also asked to introduce a little bit the formalism so to keep people on board, even if they're not familiar with this type of approaches. So that's what I will do first. I will introduce the framework of tensorial group field theories. So the idea is to have quantum field theories for the fundamental degrees of freedom building up space-time. So they're not quantum field theories on a space-time, but quantum field theories of building blocks of space-time. They generate superpositions of discrete versions of space-times in the form of cellular complexes. And of course, the idea is to show that space-time as we know it, continuum and then semi-classical emerges in some approximation. With this key idea, you recognize already the generalization of what happens for in matrix models for two-dimensional quantum gravity. That's one way to see the formalism. You write down a field theory and the peculiarity, the first peculiarity is that you have non-local interactions in the sense that the arguments of the field are paired with a non-trivial combinatorial structure. So before I start introducing this feature and then the specific models I will work with, let me make just a comment about names. There are a lot of names for different models within the same framework in the literature. You hear about tensor models, tensorial field theories, group field theories, tensorial group field theories. And that basically depends on which of the various ingredients you emphasize and whether you feel you should give a specific name to a specific subclass of models, depending on the ingredients. Here, I will just call tensorial group field theory the general formalism, and then I will specialize my discussion to quantum geometric tensorial group field theories, which is the class of models with the stronger relation to canonical loop quantum gravity, spin foam models, and lattice simplicial quantum gravity. So back to where I started. I said that these are field theories characterized by a peculiar non-locality in the way you pair field arguments in the interactions. I give you an example, the simplest one. You can consider a theory of tensors of rank 3. So real tensors taking value from some finite set or some finite group. And if you look at the, if you interpret the tensor as corresponding to a triangle with the three indices labeling the three edges, then you recognize the combinatorial structure of the pairing and tracing of indices in the interaction is the one corresponding to four triangles glued along edges. And the gluing is exactly this identification, a tracing of the indices of the tensors in the interaction. So because of this combinatorial structure of the interactions, by definition, what is going to happen is that the Feynman diagrams of these field theories are going to be dual to cellular complexes with the specific topology of the complexes you generate dual to Feynman diagrams, depending on the specific combinatorial structure you use for your interactions. Then you can, that means that if you write down the quantum partition function for such field theories and you expand perturbatively in terms of the coupling constant weight in the interaction, then the Feynman diagrams are going to be indeed the dual to cellular complexes of any topology because they will be the result of gluing fundamental cells in all possible ways according to standard Feynmanology. And then you're going to have Feynman amplitudes, which in quantum gravity models, you want to relate to discrete gravity, to some form of lattice gravity. And again, in this example, you have exactly this structure of three three-dimensional simplicial complexes dual to the various Feynman diagrams of the theory. But at this level, the amplitudes for this model, the amplitudes are purely combinatorial. You only have the combinatorial structure. The model is not rich enough to associate additional data to the cellular complexes. And so the only interpretation you can give is in terms of equilateral triangulations being generated, so that any metric information is just given by the combinatorics. So in general, these models have to have a link with lattice gravity. In the simplest models, if you only have combinatorics, then you can only have a link with gravity in the sense of dynamical triangulations, so that your simplicial complexes are equilateral. In the richer quantum geometric models that we'll discuss later on, you have a much richer form of lattice gravity and geometry in the amplitudes, and I will discuss this in the following. So already, due to this combinatorial peculiarities, there is a lot of work that is needed to make sense of the formalism at the mathematical level, in particular controlling the perturbative expansion that I just introduced. And a good part of the literature has been devoted exactly to gaining control over the topology of the diagrams you generate, controlling the large limit of such models, and defining critical behavior and some resummation techniques for the Feynman, for the perturbative expansion, and much more. There is really a lot of results also going beyond quantum gravity, but here I will stick to quantum gravity applications of the formalism. So back to the general expression for these models. As I said, in quantum geometric models, the combinatorial aspects are the same as in the simple models, but the amplitudes are going to be richer. And in fact, as I'm going to explain, the amplitudes can be understood equivalently as lattice gravity path integrals or spinform models, which are a way in which people study covariant loop quantum gravity dynamics, or more generally, the dynamics of spin network type states. In fact, the quantum states of these quantum geometric models can be understood as second quantized spin networks or simplices. So let me introduce these quantum geometric models and explain a bit of the relation to canonical loop quantum gravity and spinform models. So the basic building blocks that the field theory will be creating, annihilating, and defining the dynamics of are going to be quantized tetrahedra for four-dimensional models. So they are building blocks of space or boundary data for four-dimensional spacetimes. So let's look first at the classical level, where you can describe the intrinsic geometry of an individual tetrahedron embedded in some local flat space in 4D in terms of four vectors that are normal to the triangles that bound the tetrahedron, subject to two constraints. One is that the four vectors all lie in the same hypersurface defined by some vector n that you can understand as the normal to the tetrahedron. And then the fact that the four vectors close sum to zero, that's the condition that the four faces of the tetrahedron indeed close to form a tree cell. Now, you can understand, thanks to this constraint, the four vectors to be actually vectors in R3, so three-dimensional vectors. And if endow this vector space with a symplectic structure, you can identify these vectors as elements of SU2, the algebra of the group, of the rotation group SU2. So you can think of these vectors as, of these variables as part of a classical phase space, which is four copies of the cotangent bundle of SU2. So I'll take this to be our reference phase space for a single tetrahedron. And then the conjugate variables are going to be group elements from SU2. And they have the interpretation of discrete connection on links dual to the triangles. So what I'm doing here, just at the classical level, is associating a group theoretic classical phase space to a single tetrahedron, with one half of it being the group SU2 for copies, and the other half, the conjugate variables, the algebra of SU2 for copies. In fact, there is a more covariant characterization of the same geometry of a single tetrahedron in terms of the cotangent bundle of the full Lorentz group. One can show it's an equivalent description of the same geometry, and in fact, one can map to and from SO3-1 and SO3 or SU2. So the phase space so described is indeed the starting point, and you have to impose the constraints that ensure the geometricity of your classical data. With this building block, then you can start forming, associating a classical geometry and a classical phase space to extended triangulations formed by several tetrahedra glued together. Let's move to the quantum level. So this type of classical structure you can quantize. You have a Hilbert space associated to a single tetrahedron coming from the quantization of this classical phase space with the constraints. And as I said, you can use SO3-1 or SO3 data to do that, so that in one representation for your Hilbert space for a single tetrahedron, you are working with states which are L2 functions over four copies of the group. But of course, there are other representations coming from different definitions of a group theoretic Fourier transform. You can have functions over the Lie algebra, the conjugate variables, or you can expand in irreducible representations of your group by a different definition of Fourier transform. And that's the so-called spin representation, in which the type of data you have are irreducible representation for your group. So with this type of data, what you have is indeed a spin network vertex. So a node with four outgoing links labeled by representations of SU2. Now, I'm not discussing the interesting quantum geometry that you can study with this type of quantum data and this type of Hilbert space. I only point out that once you have the building block, the Hilbert space for a single tetrahedron, then you can define a corresponding Fock space in which you have an arbitrary number of tetrahedra. You assume bosonic statistics, and you can move around the corresponding Fock space with creation and iteration operators. So this is just studying a quantum many-body system in which your individual atom is a quantized tetrahedron with the Hilbert space I just introduced. From the classical phase space description, of course, you have all possible geometric operators. You can compute areas for the triangles, the volume of your tetrahedron. You can compute the volume associated to a larger triangulation by summing together the volume contributions from the various tetrahedra. And you have a second quantized counterpart of the same geometric operators. For example, you can consider the total volume, spatial volume, you can associate to a three-dimensional triangulation made of several such tetrahedra, by, as I said, considering the volume, the quantized volume for an individual tetrahedron, and then summing over all the contribution from all the tetrahedra you have. As you would, exactly as you would do for the total energy of a quantum many-body state. You have the energy for each atom, and then you can consider the sum of all the energy contribution. So this, of course, is a kinematical quantity. Then, of course, one has to introduce some dynamics. Before I do that, let me say a couple of more words about how you actually glue together things, because it's quite interesting. You can realize that the gluing I was mentioning of tetrahedra to form extended structure is nothing else than working with entangled states inside the Fock space. So you can take a many-body wave function for n quanta, n tetrahedra, and gluing along some shared boundary data is basically imposing an invariance under the group action. And this can be seen as a particular link map. And for every graph structure you associate to some adjacency matrix for the graph, you can have a sort of a gluing operator that leads you to a from a generic disconnected state to a connected one with the combinatorics corresponding to the graph having that adjacency matrix. So now this is, the details are not so important. What I want to emphasize is that you can do this definition, this construction in the pre-Fock space, and then you project by symmetrization. But the endpoint is that associating a graph to your state is basically recognizing that there is some pattern of entanglement among the among the quanta that your state deals with. In fact, you can show that the same states can be rephrased in the language of tensor networks, and this has a number of interesting applications that people have been exploring recently. Okay, so let's move on towards the dynamics, but once I'm still at the kinematical level, and I mentioned already spin networks, let me make a couple of comments about the relation between the type of states we have and the Hilbert space we are working with the one of canonical loop quantum gravity. So I've said that states associated to graphs, to connected graphs, are just entangled quantum many-body states in the Fock space of the tensorial group field theory. In fact, one can show something more, that the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space associated to a given graph is faithfully embedded in the Fock space. The point, however, is that the full Hilbert space in tensorial group field theories has this Fock structure, while the full Hilbert space of canonical loop quantum gravity is quite different. And the difference is indeed in the way the two formulas deal with states associated to different graphs. The general point is that in the tensorial group field theory, the discrete nature of your building blocks is somehow given priority. While in loop quantum gravity, in canonical loop quantum gravity, although you arrive at very basically the same type of structures, you impose on these structures a number of conditions that are motivated by the continuum picture behind it. In the end, this results in a number of technical differences in the way states associated to different graphs are embedded in the full Hilbert space, which I'm happy to discuss if people are interested later on. I don't want to spend too much time on this introductory part. So now we can start talking a bit more about the dynamics. So if you have simplicial interactions, you can, the idea would be to take five tetrahedra forming the boundary of a four simplex and combine the corresponding variables for the corresponding fields in the tensorial group field theory interaction, following the combinatorics of gluings of five tetrahedra in the boundary of a four simplex. With this choice, you have a particular quintic interaction term with a specific combinatorial pattern. This is a choice of model. More generally, what is happening is that once more, you have a sum over all possible simplicial complexes generated by the Feynman expansion of the field theory, and you have an amplitude associated to each of them. But now in these quantum geometric models, the amplitudes are of course much richer because I've endowed my simplicial complexes with all the group theoretic data I introduced in the previous slides. And as I anticipated, what is generic is that the Feynman amplitudes can take the form of spin-form models, So some of the histories for spin networks, or if you change the representation for your quantum states, they take the form of lattice path integrals for gravity, described in terms of this group theoretic data interpreted geometrically. So I mentioned now spin for models. So I conclude this introductory part by discussing briefly the relation of these models with spin form models as developed independently, of course, from a different point of view. So a spin form model is a collection of quantum amplitudes for all spin form complexes you decide to consider in some class, plus one way to organize such amplitudes, so to be able to compare them or to have some controlled way of computing numbers. Now, there are several ways in which you can define this, in which you can organize the spin form amplitudes. One is by defining some form of refinement of your complexes, and so some organized limit of spin form amplitudes for progressively refined complexes. Another is to sum over spin form complexes, and the group field theory, the tensorial group field theory formalism, gives you one way in which you can define such a sum over spin form complexes, as I already said, the perturbative expansion of a tensorial group field theory. That means that for any given spin form model, so a sum over representations assigned to a complex with amplitudes associated to the various elements of your complex, the vertices, the faces, the edges, and so on. For any such definition, you can find an appropriate choice of kinetic and interaction kernels for a tensorial group field theory, in such a way that the given spin form model will be produced as a Feynman amplitude of the corresponding field theory. The advantage of this is that you have, of course, a prescription for how to sum over complexes, but it also gives you a way to go beyond the spin form expansion and study the collective physics for the same type of degrees of freedom. So you go beyond the perturbative expansion of the field theory, and you have access to the non-perturbative and collective regime. And you have, of course, a number of quantum field theory tools that could be useful, and we will apply some of them in a couple of minutes. So one example of tensorial group field theory for EPRL type model is reported here, taken from the original formulation in 2007. There's no point in looking at all the details. I don't expect anybody to start looking at all the expression and somehow memorize them. You will not gain so much for what I'm going to say in the following. This is just to say that there is an interesting class of models that are studied in the spin form literature as promising encoding of quantum gravity in four dimensions. And you can write the corresponding tensorial group field theory, and then you deal with it as a peculiar quantum field theory. Both at the level of spin form model and then at the level of the encoding in a tensorial group field theory, there are a number of ambiguities, and that's why it's good to work with a sort of a parameterized formulation of the theory. Okay, and next point before I move to the actual main content of the talk is that the same guideline for constructing a tensorial group field theory that I introduced for pure gravity, for pure quantum geometry. So you try to encode the geometry of simplicial complexes in group theoretic data, and then you construct the field theory in such a way that in the perturbative expansion, you find the lattice gravity path integral. The same guideline, the same strategy can be expanded in the case of matter coupling. So you can add data to your simplicial structures to represent discretized matter fields. And you define a tensorial group field theory action so that in the perturbative expansion, the Feynman amplitude will look like a lattice gravity path integral for gravity coupled to matter. So you can do the same here. It's interesting for the later application to cosmology to introduce just a single free massless real minimally coupled scalar field, because we're going to use it as a clock. And that means extended the domain of your tensorial group field theory field to an additional real variable. You then extend the field operators, quantum states, and so on. And you write down a corresponding tensorial group field theory action. Once more, there's no point in giving you all the details of the action, but this is the type of action I would use as a starting point for the application to cosmology, where I have this type of coupling with the scalar field and the quantum geometric data are of the PRL type. So the action is local in the scalar field variable and remains non-local from the combinatorial point of view in the quantum geometric data. And it has an arbitrary number of derivatives with respect to the scalar field in the kinetic term. Okay, now I give you a formalism for quantum geometry at the discrete level in terms of discrete structures. I pretend they are the building blocks of a space-time. Now it's time to try to show you that, or at least in what sense you can reconstruct a continuum of space-time and geometry as we know them from these models. This is a common problem to all these approaches that I mentioned, tensorial group field theories, of course, but also spin form models and to some extent canonical loop quantum gravity. Let me phrase the problem from the point of view of tensorial group field theory. So I gave you a field theory, and I told you that in the perturbative expansion, you see a lattice gravity path integral embedded into a sum over all complexes. It's the full sum and the full path integral that will define the continuum theory, the full theory, so to speak. So defining the full continuum path integral for quantum gravity will amount to defining the full tensorial group field theory path integral for some model that you find promising, interesting, and you have reasons to trust as encoding the quantum geometry you need. So the point of the continuum physics from this point of view will be in the coarse-grained description of quantum gravity data. So you have somehow to resum or to lose track of the detailed lattice data to have an approximate continuum description. And in more physical terms, you're looking for controlling and extracting some interesting collective physics for the fundamental degrees of freedom you encode in your tensorial group field theory. So ideally, you have a field theory, your tensorial group field theory, you have this quantum geometric interpretation, but it remains a field theory. So you would compute the partition function, or you would compute the full quantum effective action in terms of some mean field with standard Feynman, standard field theoretic notions generalized and applied to this context. So computing the theory, defining the full theory in the continuum limit will be defining or computing the full quantum effective action. As everybody knows, this is a super hard task. Moreover, you should not expect that you have a continuum limit, because what you're going to find generically is that the system organizes itself in different phases. And the hope is that at least in one of them, you're able to extract an emergent geometric gravitational dynamics. So from the field theoretic point of view that I've been using, computing the full quantum effective action or the full continuum limit is basically studying the RG flow of the tensorial group field theory model of interest. So there is a lot of work on renormalization of this type of models of tensorial group field theories, but in fact, most of the work has been in a simpler type of models for mainly technical reasons. We have both results for perturbative renormalizability of these models, but also there are several results on the non-perturbative RG flow and critical behavior. I'm not going to discuss this. I want to admit, however, that for the quantum geometric models that I'm going to use now for extracting cosmology from the next slide, we know much, much less. We know much, much less because these models are simply technically much more complicated. But in fact, the main problem we have is not only computational, but also as a result of the computational difficulties, we simply do not know what is the theory space to run the randomization group analysis in a proper manner in. So we have a lot of results having to do with divergences or some radiative corrections by a lot of friends, but we have not been able to run a proper randomization group analysis of these models. So we do what we can. Now I start telling you what we can do. We would like to compute the full quantum effective action. We cannot. We approach the problem in some poor man's way by trying to find interesting approximations of this full quantum theory. The approximations we need, they should capture collective effects. So at this level that we would like to apply our analysis, and they should correspond to some coarse graining of the fundamental data. The simplest approximation that satisfies this desiderata is just mean field hydrodynamics. So which basically means approximating the full tensorial group field theory path integral with the saddle point evaluation, or if you want, the full quantum effective action with the classical action of the model you started from.
Daniele, there is an anonymous question. I'm also posting it on the chat already. I'm reading it. IR fixed point of tensorial group field theories under normalization group flow should be a tensorial quantum field theory, right?
Can you repeat again the question? Sorry.
So the question is whether the infrared fixed points of tensorial group field theory should essentially be T can also be topological, but TQFT. I don't know if it is tensorial or topological quantum field theory.
Frankly, I'm not sure. It is well possible that you can characterize critical points in terms of topological order parameters. And so in a sense, yes, you're going to have a topological field theory. But I'm not sure that I would say that that's necessarily what I would expect. I would be interested to discuss what we should expect because it can guide us to a different type of approximations with respect to what we use. So yeah, that's, I know, I mean, some of the arguments why quantum gravity is supposed to be some form of topological field theory. So I tend to agree with those arguments, but from the technical point of view, I'm not really sure that I see why it has to be the case at this stage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the person who asked the question wants to reply to that.
Yeah, it was actually me that asked the question. Yeah, so I did mean topological quantum field theory because I was thinking that because RG flow in my mind, when you're refining the triangulation, you can count that as an RG flow. But then if you have invariance under Pockner moves, then that makes a theory topological.
Okay, so if by topological you mean the generalized sense in which you can use topological, so indeed not depending on any geometric structure, that's you're basically using the arguments for why quantum gravity in general, regardless of whether it is defined by sum over triangulations or not, has to be topological. Mm-hmm. It would basically satisfy the Atiyah's axioms without because it will not depend on any specific geometry, and so from that point of view, I agree.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
That's what I was saying. I agree with the general expectation for a number of arguments, but if you were asking if looking at the specific tensorial group field theories we work on, I would see that the critical behavior would be given by a topological field theory. I cannot see that yet.
Maybe to clarify, you do get the topological quantum field theory if it's invariant and a Bachmann moves, and if it's local, whereas here you can have non-local terms, for instance.
Yeah, but of course, if you're talking about the full quantum effective action, you have totally lost track of the triangulation, so you are not going to have a local definition of the quantum effective action in terms of local building blocks on a triangulation.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you that it's not necessarily a fixed point of a topological quantum field theory, source of some non-locality.
Now, again, if we stay at the level of general arguments and expectations, I'm fully on board. If you ask if by looking at the analysis of the tensorial group field theories have been studied so far, at that level, I don't see it with all clarity. I hope I answered. I assume I did.
Yes,
okay,
just
so let's take this with the idea that we want to evaluate and extract physics from the full quantum effective action, however computed and defined. We actually go to the simplest approximation you can apply to the quantum effective action, which is to just work with the mean field hydrodynamics. So just with the classical action. And the mean field entering the full quantum effective action is like the condensate wave function for your building blocks. In a sense, this approximation can be seen from the point of view of the tetrahedra as working with a particular type of superposition of many tetrahedra defined by the state right there, which is a coherent state for the field operator of the tensorial group field theory. And it's like a state, a superposition of many particle states in which each building block has the same wave function, which is the condensate wave function. So it's an infinity of degrees of freedom, but captured by a single collective wave function. And looking at the type of data we have, we should not expect to be able to reconstruct a full local gravitational dynamics, because the only thing we have is the data corresponding to a single tetrahedron, basically, because that's a condensate wave function, what the condensate wave function depends on. And then you have a single massless scalar field. So with this type of data, that you have in your condensate state and then in your effective action, the only thing you can hope to extract is some form of homogeneous geometry, dynamics for homogeneous geometry. And you have a number of other reasons to expect that that's the correct interpretation of the corresponding hydrodynamics in terms of homogeneous cosmology. One being the fact that if you look at the condensate wave function, so the mean field of your dynamics, of your hydrodynamics, the domain of this wave function is given by the geometries of a single tetrahedron, but that is in fact isomorphic to the mini superspace of homogeneous geometries. So what you have is some nonlinear equation for a function, your condensate wave function, on the space of homogeneous geometries. So this wave function is kinematically the same as the wave function in quantum cosmology, but of course it's going to satisfy the hydrodynamic equation for the field theory. And so it satisfies a nonlinear equation. So it's a sort of a nonlinear extension of quantum cosmology. We are then on the way to extract cosmology from quantum gravity hydrodynamics. So a couple of remarks before I give you the technical details. There's no Hilbert space for this cosmological wave function. There is a Hilbert space for the fundamental degrees of freedom, but not for this wave function. And that's normal because it satisfies a nonlinear equation. So there would be no superposition principle for solutions. And at the more general level, the mean field type of approximation, we expect it to be valid if we have weak enough interactions. But because the interactions grow with the density, we should have smallish type densities. On the other hand, they shouldn't be too small, because at too small densities, we have basically too few quanta, and we don't expect the hydrodynamic approximation to be interesting or valid. So this type of approximation is trustable without too much worries in a sort of a mesoscopic regime. We're going to push it, on the other hand, in both directions in the analysis. So we go towards uncharted territory. So we look at the EPRL type models with the additional scalar field. We impose isotropy so that at the end of the day, the condensate wave function depends on a single spin and on a single real argument corresponding to the values of the scalar field. Then we first look at the regime in which the interactions are subdominant, consistent with this mean field approximation, as I emphasized. But let me emphasize maybe more carefully the fact that because we are relying for the interpretation of the theory and for the construction of the model on the spin foam data and the spin foam dynamics, we have to focus on the perturbative regime, because it's in that regime, weak coupling, that the spin foam expansion makes sense, hopefully. Anyway, so we look at the first at the regime in which the interactions are subdominant, so weak interactions. It's not enough to look at the hydrodynamic equation. That is just an equation for a function, for a wave function on mini superspace. We want to extract a dynamics of observables. So we need some relational clock to play the role of the time variable, respect to which we describe the evolution of geometric quantities. So we use a particular class of condensate wave functions, which peak well enough on a particular value of the scalar field. So in a sense, we are assuming that our scalar field degrees of freedom are semi-classical enough, at least from the point of view of the value of the scalar field, so that it behaves like a good clock. So this is a sort of restriction we impose to have a relational description, to have a relational evolution. Under this choice of states, this is the effective equation we get for the condensate wave function, where the various parameters and coefficients of the equation depend on the one end of the on the details of the EPRL type model we started from, and on the other hand, on the parameters of our peaked condensate states. We can rewrite the same equations in more hydrodynamic language in terms of a density and a phase. In fact, at the end, the whole dynamics reduces to the can be reduced to the dynamics of the density for our fluid, for our condensate. And the next task is to take this hydrodynamic equation and use it to obtain an equation for the volume of our universe in relational time. So we need to define observables. We define them in the full Fock space, but as expectation values in this particular type of peaked condensate states. So these are the observables we care about, the total number operator, the total volume for the universe, for our quantum states, the scalar field, and the momentum of the scalar field. These are enough as observables for homogeneous cosmology. Then we compute them as expectation value in the type of condensate state we introduced. From now on, when I talk about the volume, I mean the expectation value of the volume observable in these coherent states, in these condensate states. And the same is for the momentum of the scalar field. The condensate state was coming with the peak value for the clock. And so these geometric quantities will be the volume of our universe at the given value of the clock, the momentum of the scalar field for a given value of the clock, and so on. And the dynamical equation for the condensate state becomes a dynamical equation for the volume, where the dynamics is with respect to the clock reading. This is the equation for the volume. You get two equations. They are suitably complicated. And so we have to start analyzing them. The first thing we check is that in a classical approximation, which is more or less large volume approximation, the equation in fact reduces under the sufficient condition identifying one parameter, one microscopic set of parameters of the model with an effective Newton constant. You reproduce in fact the Friedmann equation in relational form. So the derivatives are derivatives with respect to the clock. The main lesson we gather from this, apart from being happy that there is a good semi-classical equation, is that what we call the gravitational constant in this context is in fact a function of the microscopic parameters of the theory. It's not a fundamental constant per se, as it is sort of normal in this quantum many-body emergent space-time framework. We can in fact compute in all details also the quantum fluctuations for the observables. And there are constraints on the model coming from the requirement that the clock behaves nicely enough. And in fact, one can show that the fluctuations in the volume are totally under control quite naturally at large volumes. So the semi-classical approximation that I just given is quite robust. And that is basically simply because when the volume grows, what is also growing is the number, the average number of quanta, and that suppresses relative fluctuations. But then we can actually look in the other direction at early times, relational times. And then we find that there are solutions where the singularity, the Big Bang singularity is not resolved. But for a large class of solutions, we find in fact a bouncing scenario instead of a singularity. And a bouncing scenario in fact quite similar to the one in loop quantum cosmology. In this case, again, you can compute quantum fluctuations and find for which range of parameters, so for which class of solutions, the quantum fluctuations remain small in relative terms. And then everything simplifies if you have a condensate wave function, which in fact depends only on a single value of the spin. So instead of every possible J, for whatever reason, it's dominated by a single J. Okay, so I want to close. I don't know how many minutes I have. I didn't check. Do I have 5 minutes or
5 to 10 minutes, like flexible?
5 to 10 minutes. You should not have told me. Okay, I pretend you just said 5, and not 10. I didn't hear 10, and I will try to only use 5. Okay, I want to tell you 2 things. One is just a comment about what happens. In this scenario, in this formalism, to the cosmological singularity. And the second is some recent result about obtaining some effective dark energy at late times when you introduce, when you take into account the effect of the interactions of the group, of the fundamental interactions of your building blocks of space. So let's say something first about the singularities. I just told you that for a large class of solutions, so in some generality, the classical singularity is replaced by a bounds, like in loop quantum cosmology. But so it's nice because we are in a priori, we are as far as we know in the full quantum gravity context. We made a number of approximations though. So the precise statement should be that the classical singularity is replaced by a big bounds scenario in a mean field restriction of an hydrodynamic approximation and within a condensate phase of the full tier. Now, the mean field approximation needs to be improved. I mean, the whole quantum effective action is what you want to compute and what you would like to use. So a priori, you could, it could lead to very different hydrodynamic equations, but it could well be that the bouncing scenario is stable under these improvements. If that is the case, then you can really talk about you know, the quantum bounds replacing the singularity. On the other hand, you are still in an hydrodynamic approximation and you're still assuming you are in a condensate phase. Both things could break down. For example, it could well be that at very small volumes, the effective number of quanta that you're dealing with is too small for suppressing fluctuations and also for the hydrodynamic picture to be valid at all. You don't use hydrodynamics with three water molecules. So in this sense, it could happen that you have to drop this description in terms of which you had the continuum classical geometric description of the cosmic evolution. And then you have a more radical disappearance of continuum space-time replacing the singularity. Even more, if quantum fluctuations drive the system towards some phase transition, then it's an even more radical type of disappearance of the continuum geometric space-time description. Okay, and this could actually give you can actually obtain physical signatures of this by just computing and controlling the fluctuations. And the point, the general point that I want to make is that you can express the quantum fluctuations in terms of the fundamental parameters of your model, so that fluctuations reaching some critical regime corresponds to your to values of your fundamental parameters being critical. And this could actually be a signal of a cosmological phase transition. So the whole picture of the transition from non-geometric to geometric phase is not just you know, conceptual. Is something that it could have an influence on your effective physics. And conversely, is something that you can indirectly test with the appropriate analysis. Okay, there are many results in this context. I'm not going to discuss all the many results obtained by many other friends here. I want to only spend the last 2 minutes now discussing what happens when you start introducing interactions, to considering taking into account the effect of the interactions on the full condensate hydrodynamics from the cosmological point of view. We're going to see that the general lesson is that even large scale properties of the universe could be traced back, could be seen to have a direct quantum gravity origin, which shows that the usual effective field theory intuition has limited validity in an emergent space-time scenario like this formalism. So, okay, we have extracted the effective hydrodynamics from our model. We know that on top of the kinetic part were interactions, the interactions of the most interesting models are also quite complicated. So we take a more phenomenological approach. We write down some more general type of potential that our condensate wave function could be subject to. We work in the approximation in which the coupling constant for the, in general, the interactions, the potential terms are subdominant compared to the free part, but of course become relevant when the density of the fluid, which is in fact related to the volume of the universe, starts growing. So we rewrite the equation for the condensate density in this phenomenological approach. We turn this into an equation for the volume as a function of the relational time. And we find that we rewrite the complicated equation for the volume in terms of some effective equational state for a fictitious emergent matter component of the universe. So we have a right-hand side, which is just the volume. We put all the rest on the left-hand side, and we analyze what is the behavior of this left-hand side that we interpret as an emergent matter component, which is of course of pure quantum gravity origin because we didn't couple additional degrees of freedom beside the clock and the quantum geometric data. Okay, so the analysis then is to check what is the behavior of this equational state, effective equational state. For the free theory, we know that there is a bounce at very small volumes. After a bounce, there is necessarily some short-lived acceleration after the bounce. And then we have seen that there is a Friedman dynamics. This is what the free theory tells you. For small volumes, the interactions are subdominant, as I said. And so this type of dynamics is what is relevant. Bouncing scenario, then Friedman. However, then the interactions become more relevant and they start driving the evolution. If you assume that only one mode, one value of the spin is relevant for your condensate, then the analysis has been done by Marco, Andreas, and Mary a few years ago. They have shown that quite interestingly, what the interactions do is to produce an accelerated phase that in fact can last very long. So it's like a quantum gravity induced inflation after the bounce. The problem with this is that either this expansion just doesn't end, so you kill the Friedman phase by having the interactions becoming irrelevant too early, too soon, or the expansion, the accelerated expansion stops and is immediately followed by recollapse. So once more, you don't have a nice Friedman evolution. And this is, of course, problematic from the cosmological point of view. So what we did with a student, Xian Kai, was to study how the situation changes if you have more than one mode contributing, so more than one spin value. So, of course, it depends a bit on what type of parameters you have in your model. But what you find as a general message, and now I tell you a little bit more, is that you find a nice Friedman expansion after the bounce. And later, you find a phantom-like accelerated phase at late times. So it's like a viable dark energy evolution at very late times, which is of purely quantum gravity origin. Again, you didn't couple any additional type of matter. You have that the effective equational state behaves like phantom dark energy. So the lesson is what I said earlier, that even large scale properties of the universe at late times could be seen to be of direct quantum gravity origin. And now I use my -1 or -2 minutes to just give you a couple more details about this. So under the assumption that the interactions are weak and that you need to grow large in volume to make them relevant, you have the bounce, you have a short acceleration after the bounce, you have nice freedom and expansion. You take into account two modes, and you have complicated equations to solve. So this is what the free theory gives you. Then you solve the equation for the interacting dynamics. You find that if you have as the largest type of interaction term, an order 6 type term, then the evolution of the volume gives an effective equation of state with crosses the phantom divide at -1, and then from below approaches the -1 value asymptotically. So this is really like a phantom dark energy type. The problem with many phantom dark energy models is that depending on how you approach the asymptotic value, if you're not fast enough, you are led to a big rip singularity at late times. Basically, the effective, the energy density of your phantom field will diverge. In this scenario, what we find is that, in fact, there's no such big rip singularity, because the effective energy density that we reconstruct from the equation of state and the volume dynamics, in fact, approaches quite quickly the asymptotic value corresponding to the de Sitter phase. And so you really have an asymptotic de Sitter universe. In fact, we reproduce at this hydrodynamic effective level a model of phantom dark energy that was proposed by McKim's 20 years ago in a context of, I think, DS-CFT type correspondence. Okay, so the message is what I already mentioned a couple of times. We trust effective field theory with some skepticism, because quantum gravity, if it really produces space-time as a whole, it may also affect directly large-scale properties of the universe. Thank you.
Thanks, Daniele, for this nice talk. Okay, so are there questions first from students?
Don't be shy.
Ding.
Hi, Daniel. Thanks for the nice talk.
Hello.
Hi. So the question is about trying to understand your effective cosmological models from a more fundamental perspective, how to connect the Schrödinger equation type of description with the sum over history type of description. So is there a sum over history picture to understand the resolution of the singularity and the bounds? If so, what kind of configurations am I including in the path integral? That's the question.
So you're talking about the path integral for the tensorial group field theory.
That's right. Just try to connect with the differential equation you showed when you introduced the...
Yes. Take the EPRL type action for the tensorial group field theory. So the one that if expanding diagrams gives you some particular spin form model. So it's a particular dynamics for the evolution of spin networks. Well, you take the classical action, and the classical action is, as I emphasize, it's also the simplest form of hydrodynamics you can consider, is the simplest approximation to the full quantum effective action. If your model has a coupling with the scalar field, in the sense that you have a spin form model for gravity coupled to a scalar field, you also have derivative terms with respect to the scalar field in the action. Mm-hmm. For the choice of condensate states we used, the scalar field plays the role of a clock, is your time variable, like you do in quantum cosmology. So you obtain a differential equation for the condensate wave function in which the derivatives are derivatives with respect to this clock, to the value of the clock. This is the differential equation.
This different, do you vary the action?
You vary the action with respect to your mean field, and you get a differential equation for your mean field, which is the condensate wave function.
So usually when I vary the action, I get an equation as a classical equation of motion.
Sorry, there is?
Usually when I vary the action and obtain an equation, that's a classical equation of motion.
Yeah, this is a classical hydrodynamics, but of course it's like, it's like the classical electromagnetism from the point of view of photons. It's an equation for the coherent state of your photons, which is your classical electromagnetic field. Or the Gross-Pitayski hydrodynamics is a classical equation for the condensate wave function of a number of quantum atoms.
What's quantum about
it's
this?
Classical about for your.
What
if your quanta were not quantum, you would not have any condensate coherent state.
Is it correct to think that superposition plays no role, but it's just discreteness that plays the role?
I mean, the moment you're talking about atoms, there is that type of discreteness, of course, playing a role. Then here we have the additional discreteness in the spectra of the data associated to the atoms, but this plays a secondary role in this context. So quantum is because you're dealing with a quantum many-body system, and then you look at the condensate hydrodynamics for that system.
Is there any superposition for the wave function?
There is superposition for all the quantum states, of course. In the the fundamental Hilbert space is a Fock space, is the one I introduced at the very beginning. And there you have all your superposition principle. The condensate wave function, however, satisfies a nonlinear equation because it's the hydrodynamic equation. So that will not satisfy a superposition principle. Right? I mean, if you have a condensate hydrodynamics, like Gross-Pitayski, it's a nonlinear equation for your condensate density or wave function. And because it satisfies a nonlinear equation, it doesn't have a superposition principle for solutions.
I guess I'm not familiar with the equation you mentioned.
Okay,
I don't understand why you have a wave equation when you just have a classical equation of motion. Why do you talk about a wave function?
The wave function for the condensate. So you have a quantum many-body system and you extract the corresponding hydrodynamics. The hydrodynamic density, the hydrodynamics is a set of equations for the density of your fluid and the velocity of your fluid. Now look at the equation for the density. That is, of course, it comes from a coarse graining of the atoms, but it's not something that is subject to the superposition principle itself.
So can I draw an analogy with QED? You can start with the action for QED. You vary the action, you obtain just E and M. And what you're talking about is the quantum system.
Yeah, in fact, the first example I was using, in fact, even without the fermions, it becomes very trivial, but it's really like the hydrodynamics would be the classical electromagnetism from the point of view of the photons.
Uh-huh.
The photons have their Fock space. You can take the same type of coherent state I took, and the coherent state wave function will be the electromagnetic potential.
Why is there a Fock space if I'm just doing classical
It's the one I introduced. It's the Fock space of tetrahedra or spin network vertices.
And you're not studying the quantum dynamics. So it's just a classical state and it's described by these spin networks.
I'm extracting the hydrodynamic for that quantum system. And the hydrodynamic is an equation for a wave function, for a function on your of your data. Is a collective function. But I mean, so, you
you have a comment on that? Otherwise, since there are still
I think what Ding is assuming is that what you're assuming is there's only one notion of classical limit, and what Daniele is explaining is that no, that's not true. Some objects that we call classical, like classical fields, are very quantum objects from the point of view of the particle point of view. So, you know, a classical field is a very quantum particle because it's a large superpositions of states and the condensate. So I think what Daniel is saying is starting from a notion of quantum particle of space-time and then taking an hydrodynamical limit, which of course has the feature of being classical. But, right? I hope, Ding, you can appreciate there's more than one notion of...
Right, yes.
The notion
yes.
of being classical is relative to what object you consider.
Mm-hmm. If your quanta, if your atoms were not quantum, the type of hydrodynamic equation you get would be different. And in particular, you would not be able to define the coherent state leading to the equation I've shown.
I think also Anke has something to say about this.
Yeah, no, I was just... because I think it's reasonable to sort of make the analogy with Bose Einstein condensates in many body quantum systems, right? Where you have a whole bunch of just quantum states, they condense macroscopically, and then you study their dynamics in a semi-classical manner using mean field theory. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay, just a statement of support.
Yes.
I thought it was a question. Yeah, in fact, I refrain from saying more about that because Ding said that he's not familiar with the corresponding hydrodynamics. I was not familiar either before looking into this. And the point is that if you take a superfluid hydrodynamics, it looks like a classical equation for the fluid density. Mm-hmm. But of course, there would be no superfluidity if the atoms were not, in fact, highly quantum.
Exactly, yeah.
So there's no contradiction between having a collective classical equation for highly quantum building blocks.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the condensate is macroscopic. So like it's sort of the dynamics is governed by like the classical trajectory, yeah. So to speak.
And in fact, if I can add, I guess I can. It's the condensate case, the Bose-Einstein condensate case, is also a very good pedagogic example to illustrate the difference between taking a classical limit and taking a continuum limit mm-hmm. in a quantum many-body system. And the fact that the two limits not only are different, but they do not commute.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to take a bunch of atoms and then take first the atoms of Bose liquid, but you first take a classical limit before taking the continuum hydrodynamic approximation, you would get, of course, a bunch of classical particles, and the corresponding continuum limit will give you classical hydrodynamics and not mm-hmm. The hydrodynamics of a superfluid.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Like, in fact, I think there's been work that relates like the transition into having a Bose condensed state with the fact that the limits don't commute essentially. Like, because there's a phase transition, the fact is that, as you said, like if you take the continuum limit first, then you just get classical hydrodynamics. But then if you have long range order in the quantum, off-diagonal long-range order in the quantum theory, then taking classical limit first will not see that part, essentially will not see that kind of effect.
That's also something that we keep in, well, I try to keep in mind in our spin foam lattice gravity context because now, of course, we know a lot about taking a classical limit at the discrete level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we have some control over the fact that we have nice discrete geometry and connections to Rajya calculus and so on. That's, of course, very nice as a guideline. It tells us maybe that we are encoding the right type of data, but we should take we should take into account the quantum feature of our degrees of freedom when we take the continuum limit. So we should, for a second, forget about that classical approximation, and then try to extract some collective behavior. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I see that Bianca has raised her hand. I got only the notification from Bianca. I don't know why.
So, Hank, did you finish with your questions?
I have another question, but Bianca can go first.
I'm only waiting for 20 minutes. Anyway, you made lots of choices because there's a scalar field which uses clock, which I have to couple in some way, I guess, to the GFT, which I'm not quite clear about. And you choose your hydrodynamic state. And then there seem to be also these assumptions of one spin dominating or two spins dominating, or say n spins dominating. So how much of your results are kind of universal, and so how much does depend on all these choices?
Okay, so let me start from the last one, the fact about several modes dominating, 1, 2, 4, and so on. So the asymptotic behavior is always dominated for the class of models we studied by a single mode. So the second mode has a role of telling you how you approach that asymptotic behavior. It changes the last part of the story. So we didn't do the analysis because it's super complicated, but expectation.
What is the first mode and what is the second mode? Is it the smallest spin?
Referring to this dark energy type stuff, so when you introduce the interactions, that's the only part where I restricted to one or two modes being relevant. For the free part, the bounds, the classical limit, and so on, there was no such restriction. You take into account all modes. So when you take into account the interactions, the equations become much more complicated. And so we restrict to the case in which only two modes are relevant. So that's why I was answering that in that context. So two modes is only two values of the spin are relevant at late times for when the interactions are relevant. Is this what you were referring to?
Is it the do you work with J0 and J1, or is it J0 is 1/2 and J2 is 4?
It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter so much what is the exact value. So in general, for these models, it's the lower spins that tend to dominate at late times. But from the specific point I made in the last part of the talk, which one is not really important. What is really important is that there is more than one.
Okay.
Because the second mode affects the way you approach the asymptotic regime. So this phantom crossing is because there is a second one. If you have a third one,
what happens if
there's no? If you have a third one, what I expect from what we've seen, but we haven't done the full calculation because it's difficult, is that that will further modify the previous dynamics, but again, not the approach. Because again, there will be a situation in which you have three modes contributing, then you go late enough and only two modes are relevant, then only one is relevant. And what is crucial is this last part when two modes are relevant.
There is another question.
Of course, but Bianca was correctly pointing out that of course we made a number of other assumptions about a particular type of condensate states peaking on the clock, and that is I don't have a general proof that that's the right thing, but that's the way I would expect relational dynamics to be really to emerge in a context, to be the correct description, not in necessarily in the full quantum theory, but first of all only after you have done enough coarse graining, And so you are already in the context of condensate states and mean field and so on. And then only if you have a relational variable that behaves nicely enough to be taken as a clock. Otherwise, I wouldn't see, if I have strong fluctuations in the clock value, I wouldn't really trust the relational dynamics I would describe in terms of the clock. But again, this is just an argument. It's not a proof that that's the only thing you should do.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so there is another question by Renato.
Hi, Daniele. I just wanted to know if you considering you've also considered mixing of the modes, and if that's something, yeah.
Okay, so you mean in the interactions?
Yes, exactly, indirect interaction potential, yeah.
I consider it, but then I got scared.
Okay.
No, the point is that the equation, of course, become much more complicated if different modes are coupled. The phenomenological type interaction term we used doesn't couple them. You just, every one of them contributes in principle, but individually, I mean, separately. One reason, one justification for that, apart from being lazy and not being able to do the full calculation in the most complicated case, is that the EPRL type model, the one we started from for a number of other reasons, has this type of decoupled interactions after you impose isotropy. So the way you are impose the constraints in that specific class of models leads to a decoupling of the different modes in the isotropic restriction.
Okay.
For what I know of other spinform models, this may not be the case in other spinform models.
Okay. And then I had a second question, which is related to this. You use like this scalar field as a relational variable. But I was wondering, because when we talk about relational dynamics, you can also introduce four scalar fields, which represent like, and I was wondering, mm-hmm. in also in condensate physics, I'm not an expert in that field, if there are some, yeah, condensate that, dynamics. Which
have, yeah, that's what we are doing. We are doing exactly that.
Okay.
In order to study cosmological perturbations, study inhomogeneities.
Yeah.
So if you have only a single scalar field, okay, you can use it as a clock, but you don't have enough degrees of freedom to have a notional local region of space-time.
Exactly. That's the reason why, yeah.
And therefore, if you want to study inhomogeneities, you need more degrees of freedom to be used as a clock and rods. And so that's exactly what we're doing, again, at the mean field level first. Well, as soon as we finish, I will report what we find.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Are there more questions or comments?
Criticism? Yeah. Expression of anger?
Okay, I think that there is one more question by Hank.
Yeah, I just want to... Yeah, before in the middle of the, because I really enjoy the talk, because the setup of TGFT is very similar to the nonlinear sigma model that are constructed to describe 3+1D topological phases. And in that sense, in that context, what happens is that when you want to condense a certain sector of your excitations, then those excitations have to have trivial braiding with all the other excitations in your theory. So my question is, because I wanted to ask, like, okay, what kind of condensates in the context of TGFT can you consider? And then on the very, like, 5 seconds later on your slide, you said that, oh, you assume that the condensate is, you know, sufficiently classical or sufficiently localized. So I believe that's already a sufficient condition for having trivial braiding with all the other, at least in my understanding. But I'm just wondering, like, how necessary that ansatz would be.
So, you are, if I understand correctly, you're basically asking about the statistics of the fundamental degrees of freedom. Is that what you mean by braiding?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in all these models, in fact, we assume the bosonic statistics, and it's an assumption. It's an assumption made obviously for simplicity, first of all, but also because it's compatible with the way we deal with the spin form models and lattice path integrals that appear in the Feynman amplitudes of these models. So it's the simplest case you can right. use compatible with what we know from these other perspectives. On the other hand, I have to admit we have some hints from the three-dimensional models the moment you enrich them to coupled particles, and also from the analysis of some symmetries of some simpler tensorial group field theories, the one for BF theory basically, that maybe you need some non-trivial statistics. Mm-hmm. If you start taking into account the symmetry. So it may well be that we will have to generalize the treatment to non-trivial statistics. But at the moment, I have other priorities.
I see. Okay. Yeah, that would be very interesting to see. Thank you.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so I think it is a good point to close the discussion and to thank Daniele. So I'm going to ask everyone to unmute yourself such that you can clap your hands and thank Daniele.